very warm welcome to Shiv Malik, Head of Growth at Streamer. This is part of our ABR podcast series. And just for an intro for all our listeners out there, Shiv Malik is a former Guardian investigative journalist, broadcaster, author, technologist, and co-founder of the Intergenerational Foundation Think Tank. He has previously advised the Golem Project, and is currently Head of Growth and Marketing for Streamer, where he evangelizes about a new decentralized data economy. So, Shiv, this was from your LinkedIn profile, so I hope everything's okay.
Yeah, no, that's good. it's better to keep these things short, really.
Right, okay. So let's get straight into it. First question. Firstly, you know, thank you for taking the time to talk to Asia Blockchain Review. We greatly appreciate your time and know, consideration in this whole endeavor of ours. First and foremost, how are things with you and the company as we navigate this new normal?
Thank you, Anil, for having me on. I really appreciate the invite, and it's great to be part of this kind of first batch of podcasts. Streamer is doing actually really, really well, far better than we expected. And I guess there's a kind of, you know, the internal dynamic of our company and the external one as we kind of, you know, reach out and make partnerships, try to get adoption, that kind of thing. So like internally, we were always a distributed workspace. So we have a couple of offices, Helsinki and our headquarters are in Switzerland in a place called Zug. But actually, you know, we've been using Slack and Zoom and a few other things to boot for a very long time. And so we didn't really see any change when we had to go into lockdown. I think the guys out in Helsinki, I think, missed being in the office. But actually, there was very little disruption on that end. I mean, the main thing was then on the external side was, firstly, you know, we're part of the Ethereum community, and the Ethereum community is almost addicted to having conferences. And you know, because it's got no centralized coordination, right? So people have to meet in order to exchange ideas, to understand what's going and going on in the future and even the present, and actually derive some kind of, you know, consensus about those developments and how to take things forward. So that was one thing we certainly have missed. And, you know, I don't think those conferences are going to come back until like next year, really, in earnest. And the second thing was just, you know, what would happen with the companies that we were talking to. And, you know, we're in the innovation game. And so what do people do when a moment like this hits? Now, normally when recessions hit, people actually, most companies tend to pull back on financial expenditure, and one of those things is obviously the long term and innovation. Some companies are forward thinking and think, you know, this is just the moment to invest in the future. But weirdly, with this pandemic, the consensus seems to be this is a moment for great change, and that doesn't often happen. I mean, you know, recessions hit and people are conservative. This hasn't been a recession in the normal sense. The economy literally just stopped. Right? Most recessions are kind of fear induced. And this wasn't a fear-induced thing. This was literally everyone had to stay at home. And I think people saw a different world for a brief moment. So it's been interesting because for innovation and companies, people are like, okay, what can we do that's different? And that's actually been a real positive for us.
Yeah, just, you know, moving on from that, you know, of course, with, you know, the whole COVID-19 situation and of course, like, you know, we've also got massive geopolitical sort of issues as well that, you know, most countries are grappling with now. You know, you've also got like supply chain disruptions, you know, trade war imbalances. And of course, now in the U.S., you know, a lot of violent protests and a lot has got to do also with the presidency in the country, which seems to be, you know, going off the rails as well. So, you know, I think a lot of these situations, like not only in the U.S., but now in, you know, with India, China, and, you know, a whole range of other sort of geopolitical sort of instances. You know, all of this must be quite precarious for businesses as a whole. What's your take on all of this?
Yeah, I think, again, it's feeding back into that sort of earlier question, which is that people are feeling that sense of instability. And I think that sense of instability, again, depending on which region you're in, in the world. Certainly the Americas, and, you know, I'm Britain, so we've had Brexit. And in a sense, you know, everyone's affected by what goes on in America just because of its traditional geopolitical dominance. So there has been disruption for a long while, and I think this has sort of brought it to a head. And by disruption, you know, disruption, for those who know about innovation, isn't automatically in any sense a bad thing. In fact, it can usually reveal interesting opportunity. And I think, you know, for when we're talking about data and, you know, ethics, this has been a really fascinating moment because, you know, a lot has changed. People's attitudes towards the big conglomerates has changed from both the perspective of, you know, what are you guys doing to preserve our privacy? What are you guys doing to preserve some semblance of normality when it comes to having political conversations in such a polarized time? And what are you guys doing about equality? Because the only people who've got substantially richer through what is the biggest recession since at least the Wall Street crash, if not greater, have been the FAANG companies, right? Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Google, etc. And so, you know, those are all the questions that we've been asking for a while. And I think, you know, what we're doing, in a sense, it slots right into that. So, you know, yes, there's lots of disruption. But for us, anyway, these are the questions that are being raised are all the right ones.
Yeah. Actually, talking about disruptions, like, you know, there was some recent sort of news articles and reports on the fact that, you know, COVID-19 related pressures may be making digital transformation a tad bit rushed these days. Do you think that there really isn't, you know, a problem, or rather, you know, sometimes it's all about speed because speed kind of trumps perfection, and you kind of need things to happen quickly. What's your opinion on all this?
Yeah, it's been interesting. I don't think I have anything that is a firm lesson on that, because I think it's still too early. You know, I feel like when it comes to the economy and this kind of impending recession, in a sense, people know that it might come. People think that it could also be just like a V-shaped recovery. My feeling is that, you know, actually it's too much of a loss that we've kind of faced but hasn't come out in the figures for any kind of recovery to take place anytime soon. So that isn't great. But in terms of like people, you know, either thinking about innovation or being too hasty, most companies are averse once they're settled in their ways, once they have a business model that works. You know, what ends up happening is that a next group of people come in and they're the ones who want to protect the business model, right? And they're like, just keep things as it is, right? The interests change. It isn't about necessarily massive, huge growth. It's about where can we make incremental changes to slightly increase what is already a business model, right? And those people aren't, right, very receptive to innovation. And so I like these moments which change everyone's perception and everyone's thinking around what could happen, what should happen, and what they're going to face. Because then suddenly it's like everyone's like, you know, anyone who owned a restaurant conglomerate or a cinema chain or anything that involved basically people attending in groups larger than two is now thinking, oh my god, what is our business model? Like, is it secure? And that's good for people who are on the edge thinking about innovation, right? I mean, it's not good in the sense that it does disrupt people's lives hugely and massively. But then again, you know, we've lived, I think a lot of people feel the sense that we've lived through an era in the last decade, certainly, of real economic unfairness for the ordinary people. You know, the people who have won out are people who are owners of capital, and they never seem to lose. At least if that can be reformed in some ways, we can redistribute that awkward phrase, pre-distribute, or create capital that actually works in a fairer way, in which lots more people are invested in, including those who actually create the value, then that would be a much better thing.
Yes, absolutely. I think I think some of these questions have been very broad, so I think you've been kind of
broad answers.
No, it's fine. I think it'll be a bit of a struggle for you to kind of cover So let's pivot to Streamr. Maybe it's best to give our listeners a bit of an overview of what Streamr is all about. Just a wide ecosystem that it plays in right now.
Yeah, Streamr's original vision was this, and it's still our vision now, which is: can we create a peer-to-peer decentralized network for data transportation? Right. And you're like, okay, well, why? What is that? Like, what is that for? Why does it have to be peer-to-peer and decentralized? Well, you know, at the moment, we kind of know what's kind of going on with data transportation. There's a few big players, namely, say, AWS, Amazon, say, AWS. And they control this sphere, right? How people move real-time data around the world is largely dominated by AWS. And then there's a kind of open source solutions. But the short version is, look, none of them are kind of particularly interoperable with each other. There isn't, in a sense, that common protocol that people can use. It requires either hosting your own server, if you take the kind of open source solutions, or, you know, getting billed on a kind of monthly basis, setting up an account with AWS, that kind of thing. All of this makes it very difficult to kind of create the future that actually people have been talking about for a long while, which is, you know, that smart city, which isn't just about, like, you know, sort of road monitoring or that kind of thing, right? It's actually, the holistic vision is that loads of devices that people own are in fact able to interconnect and speak to each other to make life sort of more convenient. If you want to create that kind of vision, then you have to have something a bit like the internet. You can just, like, literally plug and play, drop in, drop out. You know, it isn't gonna, you know, you don't have to have a subscription to the internet as such, right? If you've got the right device, like a mobile phone, you can just, you know, do what you want in that regard. So, you know, that's the kind of a network we're trying to create for real-time data transportation. And then we've got a second thing, which was we realized we could use that network for something else. A couple of things, including a data marketplace. But more, even more interestingly than that, we could, if you combined it with payments, right, and sending those sort of payments to lots of people, then what you could get is something that we're calling a data union. Right, it's actually a pretty old idea, which is, like, how do individuals own and control their data? You know, and no one's really cracked that problem, and largely because it rests on three things. One is, like, ordinary people need to, like, be able to transport the data, right? And you and I, right, as ordinary people, are not going to subscribe to AWS, right, to do that, right? Or, like, do you put your data on a thumb drive and, like, post it or, like, send it via email? Like, what are you going to do, right? So that problem needs to be solved. We solved that. That's great. You also need to, like, aggregate lots of people's data together because your data is not worth much by itself. And we have a marketplace that kind of effectively did that, right? Does aggregation. So that was good. We're like, okay, good. We've got two out of three. And then the third one was like, well, you know, I'm not going to do this unless I'm going to get paid. But then, you know, from the bird's eye perspective, you're like, okay, how do you pay? How does one person pay for a data set and then effectively pay the million people who make up that data set, right? That's a really hard problem because you can't use banks. You can't even use crypto as it is, because, like, the transaction costs are like 20 cents each. And if the payment to each person is 21 cents, then, you know, they're not coming out with much at the end of the day, right? It could be even less than that, and then, of course, you're losing money. So you need to come up with solutions for that, which we did. So now what we have is this, also on top of the network, is this very innovative solution called the Data Union, which means that people can basically crowdsource their data and then crowd sell it. And we're seeing a lot of success on that front.
Yeah. Okay. So just like, I think we just move on to the next bit, just Swash, the browser extension that captures, anonymizes, and sells, you know, an individual's data on a decentralized marketplace. And, you know, and so that the individual can be in control of what he or she would like to share. So, Shiv, could you tell us more about Swash?
Yeah, so, you know, we are in a sense the provider of this data union framework, right? So, like, developers can come along and start building their own data unions, and the team who were behind Swash, they're originally sort of based in Turkey and now they're headquartered in Finland. They saw what we were doing about a year and a half ago, almost. And they were like, this is really revolutionary. we want to start building away, right? We've got an idea. Why don't we create a browser plugin, right? You download it onto your browser, into Chrome or whatever you have, and it'll send that data to the data union. You effectively become a member. So, you know, you download it, you open it up, it asks you, like, hey, look, what kind of data do you want to share? We assume you want to share something, otherwise you wouldn't have downloaded it. And it gives you a menu of options. It gives you a menu, a privacy slider, like how private do you want to remain whilst you share this data? And by the way, here's the wallet address, like it's in the browser, right? That you'll get paid into every time this data sells. So they built this thing, and it's got, you know, I think almost coming up to 2,000 members now. They've been on the down low, so they haven't actually done any overt marketing. And, you know, it's taken a little while to get the back end sorted out, and that had to do with us as well as them. And, you know, they've gone through a few refinements, but it's looking really good. And it basically is like the world's first data union, right? You know, other people out there say, oh, we'll pay you for your data. But what they really mean is one of two things normally. We'll give you discounts of stuff, right? If you share your data with us, that's not paying you. That's like, you know, it's like air miles. Everyone knows that, you know, it's controlled. And that's not the same thing. It's like, well, you're still dominant in this relationship. Or the second thing is they say, you know, actually it's create more data and then we'll give you money, right? That's not the same thing either. Because that's, you know, I'm already creating tons of data out there. I want to get paid for that. I don't want to get paid for doing more work, right? Like fill out a survey, that kind of a thing. So this is new, which is like you browse the internet all the time, right? You go to platforms, you go to Amazon using your Chrome browser. Great. Well, look, all of this stuff everyone else has except for you. You don't have it. I mean, you could have it if you sat there collecting it, right? Yourself, created a program or like, you know, wrote it down. I mean, but you know, who does that, right? Why? So here's a way that they've cracked of kind of aggregating that data, and they're really on their way. They've just got some VC funding coming through now, so that's great. And as I said, it's particularly innovative.
Yeah, I'm just I was looking at the blog, and actually, I just realized that you've actually come up with a new article. We'll get to that later. One about you can't sell your kidneys, responding to objections to data ownership. So that sounds like a pretty interesting post. We'll get to that in a bit. I just have like, you know, just some of the, you know, this obligatory kind of theories that most people might have. I'll just, you know, give you a broad overview of the theories. You can just answer what you're comfortable with. I mean, do people want to own and trade their own personal data? Are they comfortable using cryptocurrency to do this? Do people care about what's happening with their data, what's being captured and exploited and all that? Do you think there are any tensions between convenience and social fluidity that digital services gives them versus what's happening with their data behind the scenes? And of course, you know, what would motivate people to join the data union and crowd sell their data? So I guess like, I mean, in all of this, I mean, essentially it's just like, I mean, I think in life, like, you know, everyone's got different perspectives on how data should be managed, I guess. And I think what you guys are doing is actually a great way to, you know, bring back some control, right, for individuals. So they can actually control what they want to do with their own data. I guess I'm just looking for like a bit of a response to all of this, you know, that whole prevailing sort of perspective that most people might have.
Yeah, look, those are a really good set of questions. And so let me try and answer them really quickly or as succinctly as possible. So the first one is, are people comfortable with using cryptocurrency to do this? And do people care what's happening with their data, right? Right now. Let me take those two things together. We did some research with about 20 people all in all back in sort of December time. When you can actually get 20 people in a room together, the good old days. And the people who did that, we asked them all these kinds of questions, and there were some really interesting answers. So one, yes, people really do care about their privacy, but they actually don't know what to do about that, right? Because they're like, well, there isn't anything. And they do live under this, in a sense, tyranny of terms and conditions. They're very aware of that, right? Mm-hmm. Like if I want to like, you know, sail the high seas of the web, of the internet, talk to people, email them, etc., shop, basic stuff, then, yeah, like, these giant pirates are going to come along and stick a knife to my throat and say, well, in order to do that, me hearties, like, you know, you're going to have to give us all your data. Otherwise, we won't let you go. And so, you know, that's very frustrating, right? To say the least. So people are massively upset by it, but they don't know what to do. So what that ends up is this dynamic of, well, I guess I don't care, right? Because if I did care, I'd have to be really angry all the time. So they love this idea of data ownership, right? When people are like, oh, right. And they actually want more control. That's really what's going on. So yes, they do want to get paid for their data. That's like a big emotional driver, but an even bigger one is a sense of control over their lives, right? They're like, oh, finally, someone who is actually giving me some control and some respect and acknowledges that I'm a human being who can't just be forced willy-nilly into whatever position that this, you know, overlord wants me to be in. Like, that's a real thing. People really feel that, and I'm sure that'll connect with a lot of people out there anyway, right? So, and as I said, that's what came through in the research, and that was fascinating. People are very happy to use cryptocurrency. What they don't want to do is like sit there, so, and basically take their fiat and turn it into crypto. That's a very laborious process, right? What this does, creating a data union effectively says, you don't have to do anything, right? You don't have to take your fiat and turn it into crypto. We'll just give you the crypto for doing the work, right? For creating value, you get paid in crypto. So they just get it dropped into their account. And that makes it a very different dynamic. It's far more convenient. It just turns up, right? in your computer. And then the question is then, how convenient, and we've got some challenges there that's, you know, for us and the whole crypto community. How do you make that convenient to then turn that digital money into other forms of digital money? That's actually pretty easy. You know, you can convert data tokens into anything very easily within the Ethereum, you know, network or ecosystem, any other ERC-20 token. Can you make it easy, though, to turn it into pounds or dollars or euros or rimbai? And actually, PayPal and a whole lot of other slew of other people have come up with, have stated that actually they do want to make this easier. And that's really fascinating because, you know, that'll make that really fluid as well.
Yeah. I was just looking through the list of questions. We'll skip a few things. I think we'll just go to the EU data strategy post that was like, basically, I mean, I'll just quickly just kind of go to the end, the sort of end bit that they had. The GDPR Article 20 needs to be amended through the European Data Act, which is to be passed in 2021, so that it allows users one-click rights. So as the board members of MyData rightfully noted, right now data portability is not good enough. What is needed is live portability. Could you give our listeners a bit of an overview on why this EU data strategy thing is important, in relation to the GDPR Article 20 and all that, and how that affects data in the big picture?
Yeah, so, you know, if you live anywhere in the world, you'll have noticed that GDPR, this European regulation, like, it turns out to affect you, right, in some way or another, which is really odd. It's funny because actually even last night I was trying to click on this article from an Oregon newspaper, and it's like, sorry, you know, you live in the EU. I mean, this is a negative side of it, but you live in the EU and therefore we can't service you because of GDPR.
Okay.
So that sometimes happens, but usually the other way is that actually you turn out like everyone has gotten, in some sense, or a feeling of getting more rights. And it's true that companies now just say we have to be GDPR compliant, even if they don't have any European customers or any significant number of European customers. Because it just makes it easier for them to operate, because they kind of just go with the gold standard, if you want. So the question is now for Article 20, what does that mean? So for Article 20 says this basically, like, you have a right to portability as an individual, right? You can move your data from one platform to another. Now, when it was drafted, if you want, this was very much about look, if I change from one bank to another bank, what I don't want to happen is that bank goes, well, this is our data about you. You know, we know where you send your direct debits and blah, 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 blah. And we're not going to give it to this other bank, you know, because. So this regulation has circumvented that and said, or made you, in a sense, the controller of that. And you say, no, bank, you've got to, bank A, you've got to give it to bank B because my life is easier and it's my data, right? That's the idea. Now, what, you know, the world has obviously changed, technologically speaking, certainly in the last 5 years. And what is now being requested that the EU do is say this: I want a right to that live feed, right? So when I interact with now social media, not just like a bank, right, which has a bunch of static files on me, I want like my feed from Facebook or Twitter or whatever it might be, Netflix. I want you to open out your API and I want to take that feed that I create. It's all about me. It's my feed. Granted, interacting with your platform, but it's me at the other end. And I want to just turn that fire hose to anywhere that I want, right? If there's a third party out there who's going to buy my data from me, great. I want to or be part of a data union to sell it as a collective. I want them to be able to have access to that feed. And that's what that revision is. Now, whether it happens or not is another question. Because, you know, as we've been told, the big companies are certainly saying, you know, hell no. Why? Because they'll lose their monopoly over the data that they have, even though we're the ones creating it, right? So they're not in favor of this at all. And there are some, I think, difficulties around, like, what exactly do you do? But, you know, we already have open APIs. And so, you know, companies, let's say, like Spotify, right? They already allow third parties access to that data. What they say is, oh, no, but, like, you can't then take that data and sell it on, right? You can't do anything, in a sense, for that customer. And you certainly can't profit yourself, right? Otherwise, we'll close down our API access to you as a third party.
Yeah,
so you know, that's really, you know, there's one or two other things that are happening as well, by the way, that look like going ahead, which is that, you know, the EU is very interested in data unions, data cooperatives, what they term as mediators of individual data sort of thing. And they're looking at licensing them because they kind of see, and I've sat in those meetings, they see this as a really good way forward. And there's a tension with GDPR, which is about privacy, and this new holistic sort of outlook, which is about ownership. They're not the same thing by any means.
Yeah, I know. I think this, I mean, you know, whenever we talk about, you know, a holistic approach, that's always like a dreaded buzzword. But, you know, I think, you know, another post of yours actually on data ownership, that was also a great read on the blog. And you've got some visions here, which of course I've just kind of oversimplified them for the benefit of the podcast. So, you know, firstly, open data, where a world in which vital and useful data is shared between all parties and made open for anyone to utilize, rather like a commons. You also talk about privacy first, where digital platforms should minimize the data created about users and personal data should remain private and under individual control by default. And sharing data should happen only in the most necessary of circumstances, and everything should also be encrypted. And of course, finally, data ownership. People should be able to take control of the data they generate through the framework of ownership. And it should be within their right to license the use of that data to whomever they choose. So, it's quite obvious that educating the masses about this paradigm shift would be quite a long and arduous sort of journey. So, what's your perspective on this for our listeners? I mean, how do you think, you know, companies or even brands, might need to approach this whole educational sort of journey for the masses out there in terms of how they should look at data and all that?
Well, I mean, okay, so in a sense, to take just one tiny step back, like, we live in a world which is pretty terrible when it comes to data, right? And I think, like, you know, a lot of your listeners will know the general outlook. You know, if you've read, like, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism by Shoshana Zuboff, you know, that you kind of get that understanding, right? We live in a world in which or Jaron Lanier, one of my favorite books is Who Owns the Future by Jaron Lanier from 2013. That was just an awesome read. You know, we live in this world of, to use Lanier's phrase, siren service, right? Like people who have all of that computing power and that monopoly over the information over the world, right? And they're surveilling us, right? And, you know, people buy, and worse than that, we seem to consent to that surveillance all the time, right?
Yes.
You know, in these contracts of adhesion, if you want, with the, you know, 70 pages of legalese that you tick a box and you've said yes to, you know, selling your firstborn. and then, you know, you people willingly buy Amazon Alexas, right? Stick them in their houses. Mm. And it turns out that you're actually being spied on. Like, people are in real time listening to you. And that's okay, apparently. So, you know, and people are like, yeah, I love my Amazon Alexa. Knowing what they know, they still say that, right? That goes back to the earlier stuff that I was saying. So that's where we are now. There are three ways of getting out of this mess, right, that are put forward by campaigners. The open data, right, make it all free financially, but also free to roam, if you want, and without controls of a sort. And then there's the privacy first lobby, who are very strong and potent, especially within the blockchain world. You know, a lot of those people are, a lot of the people in blockchain are exactly that. They're in it because of the cryptography. They're in it because of the privacy and the secrecy that allows people to avoid surveillance in that regard. And I'm very much for that. I'm very much for the tools around privacy. And then there's this third thing, which is data ownership. And that's what I'm for. And, you know, we've had these interesting debates. And I think the privacy first lobby group has kind of failed. It's failed miserably. It's failed horribly, and in a number of ways, you know. I think one of the biggest things is this, which is, you know, we've seen this with COVID. The privacy lobby group says all of your data is sacred, and nothing should be shared, really, unless it absolutely has to be. And that's not how people think. People are actually like, no, I want to share my information about myself. That's why I joined Facebook. That's why I joined Twitter. Like, I'm telling the world about me. Right. Yep. And all my friends. Right. Or if I have a deadly ish disease like COVID, I want people to know that that's the case. And I want help in return. So people do want to share their information. They are not pro privacy. And, you know, when you ask someone to treat all cases of data infringement as some horrific thing, then actually it devalues the whole sense of privacy. So, you know, I am willing to share my Spotify data. I don't care. I do care about my emails being read, but I don't care if people know my, like, what song I listened to yesterday. I don't. I just don't. Right? And I think most people are like that. So how do you create a world in which you're actually able to sort those things, like the precious from the not so precious? And I think in that sense, the things that are very, you know, I have a right to mold, to an extent, my identity in the public sphere. That's what privacy means, right? What is privacy? It's like, look, I don't want everyone to know everything about me, right? For various reasons. And I don't want particular entities like the state, who have a lot of power, or corporations who have a lot of power, to know stuff about me, because they'll really use that against me, in a sense. So, but I want to do live in a world where I can still share that information. And I think that, therefore, data ownership gives you a way out of that, right? Which is that I lease my data to other people on my terms, right? For that, you know, for those data points and data streams that I feel comfortable with. And for the stuff that I'm not comfortable with, I don't do it. I just don't lease it, right? You know, you get everyone's, like, own stuff, right? To an extent. Like, you own your belongings. And you're happy to, some people are happy to lend their books out. I'm not. I hate lending my books out. I'm very happy to lend, you know, other elements of property and lease it out. And sometimes I know that if I lend it to this guy, it's not going to be trustworthy, so I won't do that again or whatever, right? We do this all the time. And I think data should be, in a sense, really no different. And and that's, in a sense, why we've set up the system. We think it works. It does work. It's working already, but you know, there's a lot of blowback on that from the privacy people.
Right. Yeah. So before we move on to other sort of questions, which have not really that much relation to Streamer, the last one I want to talk to you about Streamer was I was looking at your blog and the Streamer blog, and there was news that the U.S. politician and entrepreneur James Felton Keith, who was an outspoken advocate for fair remuneration in exchange for personal data, he's joined Streamer's newly inaugurated Data Union Advisory Board, So that's definitely quite a milestone for the company. Could you perhaps explain to our listeners about this?
Yeah, it turns out, there's a lot of people out there. Data ownership is a very old idea, right? It's just the why it's failed is, as I said earlier, it's failed because it's technologically it's been really hard to implement, right? So, your listeners might know about Andrew Yang, who I think earlier this week, as well the week that we're recording, the first week of July, he came, he started this campaign, right, about data dividends, but his is a legal campaign. Right, he's like, look, we'll get a bunch of lawyers together and we'll sue. That's a short version. I think there are better ways to fight tech, and fighting them with tech rather than with law is actually a much better way, because they can hire lobbyists, but if the tech is good enough, then it's very hard to fight that, because you have to appeal to people, a whole bunch of people.
That's right.
So you have to use marketing and ethics, and they've lost that battle already, so they have a serious disadvantage in that regard because they've ruined their own reputations. So, when you look out over the kind of, all the people who've supported this idea of data ownership, there's a small ragtag group basically who are still in it to win it. Yang is one of them, and James, JFK as he's known, James Felton Keith is he's a great guy. He's a serious kind of he's an activist, he has an engineering background, but he's pretty adept at understanding economics and politics. He ran as recently as a Democratic candidate for in New York for office, and he's just a real powerhouse. And we've got a number of those people on our advisory board as well. So Matt Pruitt from Radical Exchange, people might know Glenn Weil, who works with Jaron Lanier. So Matt is the CEO of Radical Exchange, a think tank that Glenn set up. And he, he's got a legal background, but again, like a real kind of wise guy, like as in he's very knowledgeable and detailed thinker, which is great. We've got a couple of academics as well. So we've got and some practitioners, people who've actually set up data, like what they would know, data mutuals or data unions beforehand and failed. And so that's useful to have on your board too. So, we're kind of trying to galvanize, as any company or project would do, like galvanize the people who already believe in this idea behind what we're doing.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it sounds like it's really exciting times for streamer. So just my final few questions are just to do with the stuff that we kind of cover on Asia Blockchain Review. So, we try to do a bit of blockchain stuff, obviously, and also a bit of crypto and stuff like that. So there's just some news items that have been kind of circulating recently, and one big sort of topic now is it's all about central bank digital currencies. So you've got like China coming up with a digital yuan, and of course there are these IEOs, ICOs, and STOs as well, which are kind of complicating the whole mix for investors and buyers alike. So I'm not really sure how well versed you are with these kind of issues. I was just wondering, do you have an opinion on any of
In the kind of ICO boom of 2017, like a lot of people, and I day traded a bit. I then advised and worked for the Gollum Project for 6 months, and this is when temperatures are right up. At the top of the thermometer, if you want, and along with adrenaline and everything else, and it's heady times. But what it certainly did unleash, I think, there's a lot of irrational exuberance, as they say. But there was at least a sense that if you had a good idea, you could take it to market, and people might people would fund it. And we didn't need it to that extent of 2017. I think there were a hell of a lot of just scam projects, and some of that were just basically overt scams for
Yeah,
sure.
that's right.
And some that were genuinely heartfelt, like people were not heartfelt, it's not the right word, but, you know, they had their heart in it and they really thought that it would succeed, but just bad ideas. Mm. And then there was stuff that were good ideas, but, you know, like anything in life, any kind of startup culture, like, you're just going to have a lot of failures.
Yeah.
Honest failures, if you want to term it like that. And we're starting to see those honest failures kind of happen now. But, you know, I don't think it's very clear what this new phase looks like. We have these different instruments, but, you know, it isn't, you know, what it's clear is, you know, you could get another ICO boom if you had the same vehicles, but people are not, you know, the lawyers will say, look, you can't do this. So no one does it. And it's very difficult to have an ICO right now. So then you have to go for these other vehicles, which are untested, untried. And people are wary. And I think, you know, what was interesting about Golem was they were one of the first who had an ICO, like an overt ICO that created the model that other people could repeat. And, you know, I don't think we've seen that with STOs quite yet. Then the other thing that might very much interest me is, like, who are the people? Because, you know, if we're just going to create, like, a new kind of Silicon Valley VC model, and that's just going to lock out a lot of people, right? You know, we know the reason why it's like that is because most countries, certainly in the West, I don't know what the laws are like in Asia in this regard, but, you know, they lock out people who are not highly qualified investors, right?
Yeah,
like, people with a lot of money to lose or who have, like, highly specialized kind of education in a particular field and qualifications in that regard. And that has meant, for Silicon Valley anyway, like, basically, only if you're rich can you get richer. Only if you're rich can you take risks, right? And the little people are always, like, cut out until, you know, these things come to an IPO, which by then, like, the vast proportion of the value is, like, already unlocked. And you know, so this is a sense of unfairness. And I think the ICO boom, like, yes, lots of people lost money, but, like, the sense that if you were, you know, a person who was intelligent and had a little bit of money, you know, $500, $1,000, you could say, I want to back this project. And I love that. That's the bit I loved.
Yeah. There was like a recent study which kind of revealed that by 2024, the market for security tokens would, you know, pretty much exceed that of cryptocurrencies, and we expect it to reach about 1.5 trillion in the EU at least. And of course, you know, there's another report from the World Economic Forum that suggested by 2027, 10% of the global GDP may rest on blockchain technology. So following this methodology, the study projects that the market of tokenized assets will be worth nearly 24 trillion in financial assets alone by 2027. You think all of this is a lot of? Do you think a lot of this is hyperbole? Is not really that accurate?
Yes. This is your version. I mean, the notion that by 2027 is practically around the corner, you'll have 24 trillion worth of assets locked up. I think that is verging on hyperbole. Yeah, and you know, it'll take longer than that. Could it? You know, I've read hundreds of reports, I'm sure you have, saying, oh, look, we predict this. And what I haven't seen is a study that goes back and says, look, were any of these numbers actually right? Because they rarely are. These are all kind of, you know, attempts at reaching out into the dark. We don't know. And what we can say is this. If you actually use crypto day in, day out, to try and pay for something, like, you know, I found out recently, obviously, in the Philippines, is like, you know, 7 million or 9 million users, like, I can't remember exactly what, who use Ethereum to pay bills, right? That's really cool. That is really cool. So you can see some basic, like, how using crypto to pay for stuff is super convenient. It's way more convenient than a credit card, right? Way more convenient. I don't have to stick in my whole address and, you know, it just, you know, if you can save, you know, half a minute or a minute on payment, that is a boon for everyone, including the people who own these platforms, right? Very much so. Like, decreasing friction like that will increase sales massively. So you can see where it's going. The world will eventually adopt digital money, for sure. It's just a question of time.
Yeah. So, okay. So moving on to our final question. Obviously, the whole COVID-19 sort of crisis now, the global pandemic and all that, you know, it's made the need for decentralized economies even more pertinent. So you've got like a more widespread adoption of, you know, decentralized peer-to-peer lending. But of course, you could also reimagine the, you know, the overwhelming need for capital. So, you know, crowdfunding capital could also be back in the cards. And of course, you know, it's also said that during trying times such as the such as this, you know, blockchain systems can also provide, you know, efficiency, trust, and transparency as well through decentralization and this implementation to build more robust economies. I'm quite sure you've heard all this before. So perhaps perhaps just some final thoughts, Shiv, about you know, about the state of affairs these days, and maybe something you just want to end the conversation on.
Yeah, look, I'm very bullish about, if you want, distributed ledger technology, blockchain technology. And for me, particularly, I come from the Ethereum ecosystem. And so I'm very bullish about the Ethereum ecosystem. Like, people talk about Ethereum, but if you add Ethereum and all the other tokens that sit on top of it in some way or another, you know, then it adds up to hundreds of billions, which is impressive. And, you know, you can feel the vibrancy in that group of people. You know, we're talking tens of thousands of developers. And there's just a lot of excitement and engagement with what can be built. And that money has certainly not been wasted from 2017 and 18. It is starting to produce fascinating results. Whether it's, you know, I'm not a big fan of DeFi just because I think it's, you know, it's just decentralized financialization. Right. Yep. And I'm not a big fan of like financial tools and how they are created and why they are used have to be deeply thought out, because they can often end in Ponzi scheme like structures, you know. But if you use comp, you can kind of see, which I have done, you know, yield farming is the biggest like trend right now. You can kind of see why it might have a use. It's not obvious, and you know, it's actually pretty niche, I'd say. And so maybe that is just a bit of kind of excitement over nothing, a bit of rational exuberance, you know. But Uniswap is fantastic. Then at the other end, you can see those sort of social good things sort of starting to pop up. You know, Mise Gom, a big fan of that project, you know, and their heartland is in Thailand and surrounding sort of Southeast Asia. And they're doing, you know, these things are starting to come about, and they are really meaningful, right, for people. And it isn't just about moving money around in ways that allow the users far more control and far less expense. You know, we're starting to get into really exciting layer two, layer three, layer four projects. So I'm, you know, this is a fascinating, exciting space. My only worry is that, you know, we lose the original set of ideals for the Ethereum community, which is to be able to, tools that create human coordination, right? That facilitate that.
Yeah.
If we lose that, then we'll be no better than Web 2.
That's right. Yeah, yes, you're so right. Yeah.
No, thank you.
All right, so great. This has been a wonderful conversation. I think we haven't really. I think we'll still need to cover a lot of other stuff in the future. maybe I should try to schedule a podcast with you sometime. I don't know.
Very happy to come back.
We'll sort something out. Because I haven't gone through that poster, you know, that you. I'll definitely have to follow up with that. So, thanks, Shiv. It's been great, you know. Wonderful conversation. Thank you very much.
Enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.